All right, Jen Cooper, the keeper here for the next episode of the Mix Zone Women's Soccer Podcast. This is episode number 81, and born in 1981, two great American keepers. That's right, Hope Solo and Nicole Barnhart, both born in 1981. Solo holds the all-time caps, starts, and shutout records for the U.S. Women's National Team, while, of course, Nicole Barnhart was her backup for most of Solo's career. Barnhart no longer with the national team. Solo still going strong. Also born in 1981, Christy Welsh, a striker who saw time with the U.S. national team off and on. And she was the first player from Penn State to win the Mack Herman Trophy back in 2001. So anyway, the draft for the historic fourth season of the NWSL is this Friday in Baltimore at the NSCAA convention. It starts at 10 a.m. Eastern time, and I promise you that the Keeper Notes coverage will be bigger and better than before. Keep an eye on NWSL's Twitter, Facebook feeds, etc. Hint, hint, nudge, nudge, know what I mean. And make sure that all your electronic toys are fully charged before Friday morning. For those anywhere near Baltimore, just make a day of it. Drop by the ballroom of the Baltimore Convention Center. Fans are always welcome at the draft. So, of course, both chats in today's episode are heavy on the draft talk. First, I spoke with Hal Kaiser about how he thinks the first six picks will fall and what each team needs to get from the draft. We also chatted about the FIFA award winners. Spoiler alert, Carly Lloyd and Jill Ellis won. And then I talked more about the draft and also the fall NCAA Division I season as a whole with Jennifer Gordon of Equalizer Soccer. All right, Jen Cooper, the keeper here with Hal Kaiser, Der Kaiser of not only Houston soccer, but now I'm starting to think women's soccer in the U.S. Hal, thanks for joining me today.
Don't forget Korea.
Oh, and Korea. Der Kaiser of Korean women's soccer. All right, Hal, before we talk about the draft and team needs and, you know, a lot of stuff that's going to happen this week around the draft in Baltimore, want to get your thoughts on, you know, we just had the announcement about an hour ago that Carly Lloyd won FIFA Women's World Player of the Year and Jill Ellis got the Women's Coach of the Year.
Yeah, and it's, well, you know, this is a year where probably the decision-making was really driven by the World Cup and not necessarily what happened outside of the World Cup. So with that in mind, I mean, Carly Lloyd's kind of a no-brainer. When she turned on was when the U.S. turned on in the knockout rounds, and the hat trick in the final is a pretty memorable thing. So I think it was probably pretty well-deserved. I mean, there were other players who were great, not just the World Cup, but also all year long, but she had just a dynamite World Cup and pretty good, you know, international run after that as well of goals scored. So no surprise to see her win. Jill Ellis, you know, if you look at the way FIFA votes, I mean, sometimes I think that, and this is not a, you know, specifically related to Jill Ellis, but I think sometimes the FIFA voters really, you know, you look at the list of people who vote, you know, there's a lot of people who don't necessarily, there's just too much soccer in the world.
Right.
And so, you know, you tend to go with some of the obvious names. And I mean, we even look back, what was it last year that Abby Wambach was shortlisted for the World Player of the Year, despite the fact that she missed the entire year with injury, more or less.
Right, right.
So, I mean, Jill Ellis, I mean, the U.S. won the World Cup. I mean, let's be honest, going into the World Cup, I don't think any of us thought the U.S. would win the World Cup. And the first, you know, the group stage and the run-up to the World Cup was a bit of a mess. So it was, you know, probably deserved. I mean, I would make a case for Mark Sampson, England. You know, nobody thought England would get anywhere near the semifinals. And not only did they get near it, but, you know, except for an own goal, they might have been the team that the U.S. was facing in the final.
Right.
And they beat
Germany for the first time ever in that third-place match.
Exactly. And they gave Japan a great match. And it's not – I mean, you look at expectations versus outcome. I mean, so Japan's coach finished second in the voting. Mark Sampson finished third. I mean, Japan was always, looking at their draw, was always a favorite to make the final. I mean, they really didn't have a hard path.
Right.
The U.S., like I said, I think they did better than probably most of us thought they would. So, again, you can make a strong case for Jill Ellis, but I think Mark Sampson, I think if you were voting strictly on expectations versus outcome. And I mean, I was at a couple England games, the tweaks that he made throughout the tournament with his team, were really, he made a lot of changes, and he found the right combination of players. He rode streaks. He did a great job managing, so I thought he deserved it personally, but I can see why Jill Ellis won.
Yeah, I was definitely leaning towards Mark Sampson as well, that just taking that team from taking it over from Hope Powell, he did such an amazing thing with that team, you know, the run that they had in the World Cup. And like you said, the tweaks that he made, it kind of, you know, the whole performed much better than the individual parts, that everybody yes. rose to a new level. And I just, I don't think he got enough credit for that. I'm kind of surprised that he didn't at least finish second in the voting, because Japan, yeah. like you said, kind of, you know, not a really strong path. And I think it's always hard in a World Cup year for a voter to not give it to, well, this person won the World Cup. But, you know, we keep coming back to it, but it has to be said, if Megan Rapinoe and Lauren Holliday didn't get the yellows in that quarterfinal, would Jill have, you know, made the changes that she made that led to, you know, such a spectacular knockout stage run for the USA?
We will never know, but I'd love to see. I'd love to see a Man in the High Castle kind of alternate reality where we see what would have happened.
That'd be great. Well, and I also want to say that I was frustrated that there wasn't a single club coach in that final three, because when, you know, Japan's coach was kind of a weak choice for the final three. But again, I could see someone voting who didn't follow women's soccer going, okay, well, his team made the World Cup final. You know, I don't understand why Laura Harvey or Wojtek Wendanowski, or perhaps a coach from the Women's Champions League that I don't have a chance to see very often, you know, see their team, should be in there as well. And this is the thing that I'd really like to see over the next several years, is just more attention paid to the whole breadth of the game. I mean, yeah. no one can argue Carly Lloyd's performance of the Women's World Cup, but she did not have a complete year, you know. And I think when we look at the men's award, they're looking at the player that has a complete year. So we'll get there. I would like to hope, I haven't seen the votes yet, but, you know, they always release the votes for everyone. And the voting is, each country gets, what, the coach, the
captain, and one media. Yeah.
So I hope when I see the votes that there's no one on that list that is voting for a player that's retired.
Yeah, I glanced through them. I didn't see, well, I mean, of course, Celia Sasic, but she was, you know, she played for...
I meant retired several years, yeah, like people yeah. used to vote for Michelle.
Yeah, there's no Mia Hamms on there. That's
yeah,
right. Yeah,
yeah.
Yeah, I flipped through it. Nothing jumped out at me.
That's a step in the right direction. But anyway, yeah. let's come back stateside and talk about the NWSL draft. We have in Baltimore this Friday. It's going to be bigger than it's ever been before. It's going to be in the Baltimore Convention Center ballroom, the biggest yeah. space in the convention center, the same space that MLS uses. You know, so we know that the production of it is going to be bigger than it's ever been before. And it seems like that we kind of know who the top pick is, at least when you look at Twitter, that everyone seems to have the same consensus that it's Emily Sonnet. And do you feel that way, Hal?
Yeah, I think Portland Merritt Paulson's even sort of tweeted it himself and then deleted those tweets, as he often does, that's their pick. I mean, I don't think there's really any question there. She's a great defender. Certainly being called up to the U.S. national team and having the appearances that she's had in the last few months helped boost her stock. But she looks like a comfortable first round pick, number one pick, and Portland, frankly, could use a center back to kind of lock down one of those center back positions anyway for a long time. So it makes a lot of sense.
So she really feels a need for Portland. And Portland at this point has the number one pick, the number two pick, the number 10 pick, but we know that that's likely going away. I mean, it seems all but official that Lindsey Horan is coming back to the States, will play with Portland, so that number 10 pick will revert to Orlando. So let's just pretend that's a done deal. So you're Portland, you've got the number one and number two pick, as well as number 21. That number two pick, is that something you want to trade? Is that something where will you just pick the next best player, or what do you do with that pick?
Yeah, I would think if I'm sitting in Portland's shoes, my first effort is to try to trade that pick and see what kind of value I can get for it. I mean, when I look at Portland, you know, up top, forward slot, they've got Christine Sinclair, who's getting up there. They've got Jody Taylor, You could throw Lindsey Horan up top as well. But you know, they could use another good forward, and I don't know that you necessarily have that coming out of the draft. Anybody that you're comfortable with? I mean, I know a lot of people like Mackenzie Doniak, and I know Mark Parsons has raved about her in the past as well. I just don't, you know, I think getting her at two, my personal opinion, getting her at two is reaching just a little bit. Mm-hmm. They could probably trade down and get her if they really wanted her. Bring in some more experience with that pick. You know, to me, the logical number two is Raquel Rodriguez. But when you take into account all the rumors of players who are coming to Portland, there's no real spot for Rodriguez to fill. So I would try to capitalize on the notoriety that Rodriguez has gained. I mean, she already had a lot of notoriety, but winning the national championship and everything and Hermann Trophy, and see if you can't get something good out of somebody for that pick.
Definitely. And the number three pick goes to Sky Blue. You know, so again, it's so much is going to be dependent on what happens around it. And that sounds kind of cliche for a draft, but it's really hard to figure out who's going to take what. You know, like we were just talking about Portland, you kind of know who number one is, but number two could go a couple of different ways. But
yeah, to me, when I look at my draft, when I think about what my mock draft might look like, number two is such an important pick because it swings the rest of the first round from my standpoint. Because if Raquel Rodriguez goes two, then if I'm Sky Blue, I have to be thinking about, you know, Christy Rampone isn't going to be there much longer, and there's Ricaro sitting there, who's another player who you could plug in and fill a center back spot for a very long time. But in the meantime, she can also play. She's very versatile. She could play in the midfield for you as well.
Right.
So I'd be thinking long and hard about her. But if Doniak goes two, then all of a sudden Raquel Rodriguez is there. And I don't know how, if you're Sky Blue, how can you pass up on Rodriguez? You really have to take her. And that sort of cascades down from there. And the other player they could be thinking about is maybe a Rachel Daly. They have Sky Blue has the international slots to spend, and she's another versatile, really good player. But then the other pick that I can't, you know, I look at Seattle and think about what are they going to do, and I have a really hard time there too. So I think two and four is really going to dictate how the rest of the first round plays out.
Yeah, Seattle having the fourth pick, and it's strange trying to figure out what Laura Harvey might do. She's not really into the draft. When I look back at historically the players she's drafted, that's not where she gets her players.
Yeah.
So, you know, I wouldn't be surprised if this pick gets traded, or if it's, you know, she's tried to trade it for something else. But if she has it, well, you know, what does she do? What needs does Seattle have to fill?
Really fullback. They could use a fullback, some wide depth, especially with Megan Rapinoe, out with the injury that she has. So there, you know, if Rachel Daly is available at four, again, she's versatile. She can play fullback. She can play, up top. She's a good forward. You can move her around a bunch of different spots. Plus she's English. So there's the English connection there with Laura
right.
Harvey. So I could easily see them going with Rachel Daly if she's available at four. I mean, the other fullback that's sort of on the top of people's list is Carson Pickett. I mean, I guess stepping back, I look at this draft as a whole, and there's only three players that I don't look at and go, yeah, but. And that's Sonnet, Rodriguez, and Ricaro. Everybody else, I see flaws. There's, yeah, they're good, but. And I don't know. I mean, we look at last year's draft. There's so many players who came in and started on day one and really had an impact. I don't think you're going to see much of that this year. I think we don't have a lot of players that are really ready to play today. It's kind of more depth moves. And that makes it that much more unpredictable in terms of what players, what coaches will do and who they see, who, you know, they don't expect to help right now, but they see a lot of development potential in them. So they're just going to grab them and go.
And that's a really good point as we come into talking about picks number five and six for the Houston Dash, because of all the teams, it seems like Dash has the most needs to fill when, you know, you put together the current rosters, and it's kind of hard to do that in some respects, you know, to see how many spaces are actually available. There's a lot of space available
for the Dash. So if you've got 5 and 6, which is, you know, great for them to have two first round picks, you know, who are you looking at, you know, for the Dash? What needs do they need to fill the most?
Everything, really. I mean, the if you were to say what is the highest priority for the Dash, what do they need to really fill? It's defense. And the question becomes, oh, can you really do that effectively out of the draft? Picking at 5, are you going to be able to get somebody who can help you this season on the back line? Because with Megan Klingenberg gone, Tony Presley gone, they're back to where they were last year effectively at the start of the season where their back line was a mess. If Recaro is there still at 5, Waldrum knows her really well. That seems the natural pick at 5. Outside of that, I don't know that there's really anybody who you're going to get on the back line that's going to come in and help right away. So in my mind, if I'm the Dash, I'm thinking a lot about trading at least one of these two picks and getting some more experience, getting somebody who can actually come in and contribute right away.
Gotcha. And yeah, because there's teams below us that don't have, like, Chicago's earliest pick is, you know, 19.
Yeah.
You know, Orlando's. Or I guess Orlando will get number 10 Boston.
10. Boston's release is 17. Yeah.
Yeah.
Western New York has 9 and 11. You know, they might. There's enough of a drop off quickly in quality in this draft that, you know, they might deal you 9 and 11 for a pick if you wanted to drop down. I mean, there's a lot of players in this draft that I look at that I say, well, they're interesting, but they're not going to help today. So you could drop down to 9 and 11. Let's say, for example, and get two players that may have a lot of potential in the future, but again, that doesn't help you today. And what the Dash really need is help today in defense. They need depth in the midfield because they have three great midfielders that will be starting in Andressa, Carly Lloyd, and Morgan Bryant, but they're all going to be gone for the Olympics. So you need to have bodies that are going to be able to fill in behind them. They have a lot of needs. They have a lot of needs and not a lot of ability to fill them.
And then following the Dash, and at this point we don't really need to follow the draft order because this is really going to be a crapshoot. You know, it's I think the first 5-6 picks, we kind of have a sense of who it's going to be. It'll just be a matter of order. But after that, I think it's really going to open wide as, you know, there's not a lot of space on rosters. Like you said, these aren't necessarily players that can come in and be starters and have an impact today. So you're just... You know, some coaches will probably grab the best player available. Some may look to specific team needs. So let's say you're the Washington Spirit, you know, new head coach Jim Gabara, though, of course, he's been coaching in women's pro soccer since, you know, 2001. You know, what are you looking for the Spirit roster? You know, you've lost Ashlyn Harris. You know, what else?
Well, theoretically today you have an open spot for backup keeper, but we know fairly certain that Stephanie Labbe is going to be allocated to Washington. So they don't really need a keeper. I mean, from there they could use, I mean, their forward situation looks really good. Their midfield situation looks pretty good. What they could use is some defensive depth, but you know, they're sitting on 19 players already. They only have one open slot and there's not a lot of players on there that are obvious players that need to go. So there's not a lot for them to fill. So I would expect them to go with some kind of defensive depth probably.
And then Kansas City, our champion from both 2015 and 2014, you know, losing Lauren Holiday to retirement, Amy Rodriguez now pregnant, Leanne Robinson, now Leanne Brown, retired, probably not going to see the return of Jenna Richmond, who took last year off. What, you know, again, not a team that I think has leaned very heavily on the draft in the past, you know, so if you're Władko Andonowski, what are you looking for?
They've got some big holes to fill in the back. Certainly at a minimum, they need some depth, but they had three key departures really on the back line. So they need to do something there. And then I wonder, you know, when they traded Sarah Hagen to Orlando, I wonder if they knew at that point in time that Amy Rodriguez was pregnant, because if you look at their forward situation now, taking on Amy Rodriguez out of the picture, and they look really weak up top as well. So defense and forward are the two clearest areas of need for them.
It's going to be a very different Kansas City picture. I mean, we already knew we were going to be losing Lauren Holiday, but to lose the other part of the tandem, you know, Amy Rodriguez, that's a hit, you know.
Yeah, and like you say, Leanne Brown, Amy LaPelbit, I mean, that's a lot to replace in one season.
All right. What about Western New York Flash? I mean, again, it seems like they are completely rebuilding. Aaron Lyons, the coach of 7 years through four different leagues, stepped down. So they still don't have a coach at this point, though Charlie Nemo is kind of, running things. He's what, general manager? Is that his new title?
He's technical director.
Technical director. You know, so at least they have somebody who has his, you know, fingers in all the pies. Lots of changes for them. They got rid of any player that played for them in 2014 at this point.
Yes.
So it's almost a new roster for the Western New York Flash. So what do you think they're going to do with the draft? Like you said, they've got 9, 11, also 14. So three picks, you know, in the top 15.
Yeah, and they really, I think if you look at what their starting lineup is likely to be on day one, it's pretty well set. So what they can use is depth. I mean, particularly some defensive depth. And a lot of that depends on what they want to do with Abby Dahlkemper. If Dahlkemper is going to drop back and be center back alongside Abby Ersig, you could use some depth there. If she's going to be a defensive midfielder again, then you probably really need to have to find a way to get another starting center back. But either way you cut it, they have four good defenders on the roster, but nothing behind them, so they need depth.
And then Chicago, made the playoffs last year for the first time. They did, I would say, by far the best during that period of, you know, the top players being gone for the World Cup. You know, we know that Rory Dames totally rocked the draft last year, got so much out of those draft picks. And you look at his previous draft picks, they tend to stay, they tend to play. I mean, he clearly likes to pick players that he's known in the past from youth coaching. You know, so their first pick in this draft is as low as 19. So like many teams, they don't have a lot of space. But what do you think Chicago needs to focus on in this draft or just needs to fill?
There again, they're really a team that is pretty well set from a starting standpoint. So it's again, depth. Depth at the back. They made some moves back there that left them a little bit thin. Julie Johnson and probably Samantha Johnson is going to partner up with Julie Johnson in the middle. And then you have Aaron Gilliland, and they brought in Casey Short to play out wide. And, you know, beyond that, there's not a whole lot there. So they could use some depth players to back those players up. And same thing in the midfield, mainly kind of out wide. They could use a little bit of depth there as well. But from a starting standpoint, they're set. I mean, they're in the best position you want to be in, where you pick the best player available that gives you some depth, perhaps, and you don't worry about the rest.
And I think that's what we're going to see from Boston. Unlike last year, where, you know, they had some higher picks, and I remember very clearly Chicago taking Stephanie McCaffrey number 5, kind of because they knew that Boston wanted her. That was just so telegraphed. So then Chicago traded McCaffrey to Boston and got themselves 2 more picks. So like we said, Rory Dames rocked the draft. Boston making a lot of great changes in the offseason. Coach Matt Beard coming over. He coached Whitney Ingen and Libby Stout at Liverpool. I'm already seeing in that roster, you look at it and you're like, this is a new Boston. This isn't going to be the same old, same old. So I think they are similar to Chicago in this respect, that they're not looking to get a lot out of the draft, especially when your first pick is, 17 overall. So it's just, hey, whatever we can grab, if they're great,
Yeah, I mean, you could see them maybe grabbing one of the couple keepers that's worth taking as a backup, replace Jamie Cranick.
Mm-hmm.
Other than that, I mean, depth at the back, depth up top, they could use attacking midfield depth, but they don't have any strong, obvious needs that they need to fill out of the draft.
And then last but certainly not least, our expansion team, Orlando Pride, Tom Sormani back in women's club soccer for the first time in a long time. I don't know if, a lot of our listeners will know about the amazing trade that he engineered when he took over the New York Power for 2003. I spoke to him about this last year, and he talked about getting roundly criticized for this trade, but he traded away the number one pick in the draft so that he could get Shannon Box,
which turned out okay.
Yeah, and because of that, and this was pre Shannon Box even being in a national team camp. But he told me that every time he watched her play against the Cyber Race, who he's assistant coach for. He's like, that she was the only player who could shut down CeCe and Katya from Brazil. He's like, they don't know how to get around her. So he always remembered that. So when he took over New York Power, he's like, I want Shannon Box. So I want to keep that in everybody's mind that, you know, he looks like a nice guy, but he can do some masterful trades. But at this point, Orlando has a pretty healthy roster, you know, like Boston, like Chicago, probably just going for depth, kind of, you know, rounding out that roster. Very likely to have that 10th pick with Horan going to Portland. So, you know, who do you think Orlando's going to walk away with in the first round? Or what do you think they need to get with that first round pick?
I mean, I would say they pretty much need everything. You know, they're an expansion team. They still have four open slots to fill. And if you look up and down their roster, like you would expect with an expansion team, there's some good stuff. And then there's some kind of so-so stuff. And then you have players like Steph Catley, who could be gone for most of the season with Australia. So, I mean, defense definitely stands out, but so does the midfield as well, with players that you can expect to miss some time. But, you know, so really, I mean, I would see them, like you say, as one of those teams that we need everything. So whatever we think is the best player available, when our turn comes up, that's who we're going to take.
And of course, information that impacts the draft that we still don't have, though we have some rumors and some tweets, is the U.S. allocations for 2016 aren't out. The Canada allocations for 2016 aren't out. And of course, that can impact the draft. I mean, you talk about a Janine Becky. It's like, well, if she's allocated, does she go through the draft or not?
Yeah, and I mean, Canada has set a precedent twice for players who are coming out of college that are part of the national team program, just directly allocating them as opposed to going through the draft. So you're right, you could see Becky go there. I mean, the other thing is with Canada, from what I've heard, there's a move towards youth. So you're going to see a player like Sabrina D'Angelo will get allocated, a couple of the other youngsters. Some of the older players won't be allocated. We've already seen that with Melissa Tancredi going overseas because she wasn't going to be allocated, and that will impact rosters. The other thing that, of course, came out today is, and this doesn't really have much of an impact, but the strong indication that Mexico is out of the allocation system. They won't participate this year.
And they were barely in last year, especially when their players were not even here until after the Pan Am game. So I want to go back and look. Did any Mexican players get any minutes last year?
No, none.
Yeah. So yeah.
Not a single one. So it doesn't really have a huge impact. But I mean, coming back to Becky, she's a player who is more than likely a first round draft pick if she's in the draft. And if she's allocated, then it does two things. One, it takes her out. It pushes other people up. The other is a change one of the team's needs in terms of what they need to go out and get. So we'll hopefully, you know, any day now we'll see allocations, because that is important to trying to figure out who's likely to take who and putting together mock drafts and things like that.
And it's been such a crazy off season with, you know, expansion, the expansion draft and player trades and more information than we were used to getting in the off season. But still there's all of this, okay, what are the allocations and when will the schedule come out? I mean, we saw a tweet from NWSL that it'll be February. And, of course, we understand that they can't finalize their schedule until MLS is finalized because they share some venues. And, of course, MLS is waiting on – has waited on other entities. But yeah. I kind of feel like, can at the very least we say this is the opening weekend, you know, and we know these three teams will be hosting. They did that last year, I think.
Yeah, and I mean, the sense I have is they've already figured out what they're going to do for the Olympics, so therefore, you know, they should have figured out when the season starts and when the season ends. So you're right, that would be nice. But, I mean, we know it's a small office. There's a lot of things going on
right. All
at once, so it's not necessarily a huge surprise. And the other thing that we need to see this week that hopefully will come within a couple of days of the draft is the final draft list, because we know there'll be players who aren't on there right now who will be added, and there's players who are on there right now that will come off. I mean,
right.
Claire Faulkner of Florida just signed with Bayern Munich this past weekend, so she's out, or you would expect that she's out anyway.
Right.
There's other moves. I mean, there's rumors about, so there's a lot of international players in the draft right now. There's a lot of rumors of some of them not actually playing in NWSL and signing deals overseas. So we need to see that final list to know who's really in the draft. Is Raquel Rodriguez really going to be in the draft? Is Katie Bowen really going to be in the draft? Rachel Daly, so on and so forth.
And players can declare as late as Thursday the 14th. And, of course, there might be people that declare for the draft, even if they're planning to play elsewhere, kind of you want to keep their options open or,
yeah,
you know, like Omobagu, Arden last player, you know, that she was, I think Sky Blue drafted her last year.
Yeah, in the fourth round. Or yeah. Another Amber Brooks was another one who signed with Bayern but was in the draft. So Portland took her in the fourth round.
Right.
It definitely happens.
So that's really just, in some ways, just claiming dibs or keeping your options open.
Yeah, and I mean, what tends to happen, like, nobody knew. I mean, none of us in the media, certainly, and the fans knew that Ubogagu was going to be going to Arsenal at the time. But clearly, that had been communicated to the teams, and therefore, she went a lot later than people would have expected her to go otherwise. So if you see a player who you think is going to be a first-round pick, and all of a sudden, they're falling off, nobody's taking them, then that's probably a good indication that they don't plan to play in NWSL next year.
Yeah, and we may not have that information, but the coaches clearly have that information, which is why they're, you know, not picking. Like Jordan Day from Texas A&M last year, she made it be known to the coaches the night before that she was probably not going to play the season. She, you know, she was just waffling, I think, about injury issues or what she was going to do. So, you know, it's nice that she put it out there. It's like, don't waste a pick on me. You know, she eventually did join camp for the Houston Dash and was on the bench for a few games. But, yeah, and even like we saw last year, we may see some more retirements this week. You know, we had Marissa Diggs the night before call Randy Waldrum and say, yeah, I'm going to retire. I got this other job offer. And so then that, you know, change what the Dash needed to get with their fourth round pick. Mm. So we could see some more retirements as well. It's going to be a crazy week for women's soccer, which, you know, I hope most people have next Monday, Martin Luther King Day off, so they can recover from all of this. All right. Last thing, Hal, because we've talked about a lot of different topics. Last thing, it was announced this weekend that Carly Lloyd and Becky Sauerbrunn have taken over the captaincy of the U.S. women's national team. Any thoughts on that?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's a good choice. I think Becky Sauerbrunn is a great player, a great leader, but I'm not always such a huge fan of having a goalkeeper or a defender as team captain because they don't tend to – I mean, they tend to be staying back most of the game, so they're not necessarily there flowing around having access to all the players. You know, it's nice that they go with a co-captain, and Carly Lloyd's not necessarily the most vocal individual in the world, but she definitely leads with her play.
Right.
And she certainly deserves it as a senior statesman now on the team and the year that she's coming off of. So I think good choice all around. There's really nobody else that jumps out as obvious selections you can count on always being in the lineup and being that type of leader that you want to hand the captain's armband to.
And Carly addressed that, you know, in the little pre-video for the Ballon d'Or ceremony today, is how she really became a leader this year, you know, above and beyond stepping up her game, that, you know, she became a leader in it. And it clearly shows. And I love the backstory of, you know, if you've ever read Hope Solo's book, and she talks about how she and Carly kind of became friends after what happened in 2007 at the Women's World Cup, because they both felt like outcasts on the team, that they weren't your normal kind of team players. And I don't mean that in a derogatory way, that they were just loners and that they weren't necessarily extroverts. And Hope even joked that she was amused to find out that Carly was incredibly intimidated by Hope. You know, and you think about that now, you're like, wow, really? You know, so I love the story for Carly, that, you know, how all that hard work paid off. And it was really moving today to see her walk up and take that trophy and be speechless.
Yeah, it was.
Yeah, that was kind of cool. Well, anyway, Hal, thank you for all your insight and opinions. And you and I will both be there in Baltimore. And I know we don't have a lot of details with people to share about the coverage, but there will be coverage, and it'll be bigger and better than ever. And as soon as we can announce it, We will. We promise.
Yeah, it will be great coverage. And, of course, keeper notes. I'll have mock drafts and stuff like that out. And then we can all laugh afterwards about how wrong I was when completely different things happened.
All right, Hal. See you in Baltimore.
Okay, see ya.
All right, Jen Cooper, the keeper, here with Jennifer Gordon from Equalizer Soccer. Jennifer covers a lot of women's soccer, but especially college women's soccer. Jennifer, thanks for joining me today.
Hey, thanks for having me.
Well, tell me first, before we get into the college WOSO talk, how did you get into the position of covering women's soccer for Equalizer Soccer?
Basically, Jeff Kasouf, the managing editor, sent, I think it was a tweet around, said he was looking for potentially people to cover teams. And this was right after WPS folded. And he said he was, you know, looking for people to cover teams that would be in specifically the WPSL Elite and then a couple of the now defunct W League teams, and lived in the right area, sent him a resume, and it just kind of went from there. I was covering DC United Women, which was kind of the front runner to Washington Spirit, and then the ASA Charge from the WPSL. So it was really interesting summer.
And then it just took off from there, and you've been hooked.
Here 3.5 years later, almost 4, I guess, still.
And you've
still keeps me around.
You've kind of become like the college soccer beat writer for Equalizer. So how did that become your niche?
I think a lot of that had to do with these teams in WPSL Elite and the W League had a lot of college players on it. And I had seen some games. My husband's a Maryland graduate. I'd seen some games at Maryland. They were playing in the ACC. So they were playing against some pretty good players. And I was, you know, interested, but I was in law school at the time. So I didn't really have time to, you know, write. But then I figured, hey, why don't I, you know, see if Jeff would be cool with me covering, you know, Maryland, since they're pretty close, they play some pretty good teams, and we really didn't have a lot of things to cover in the fall. So it kind of grew out of that. Like, I was covering Maryland specifically, and then it kind of just, and a couple of pieces here and there on other teams, and kind of grew from there.
And it's so hard to find coverage of college soccer, not just women's, but also men's, because there's so much of it, you know, and we have such a saturated sports landscape. So when there was something that you didn't know or information you needed, you know, where did you find it? I mean, as we've all been preparing for the draft this week, it's like there's just not a lot of information out there.
Top Drawer Soccer has always been a website that I've gone to specifically for. They have a lot of times they do like previews for different teams and stuff like that, and they do like goals of the week and things of that nature. They do a very good job of covering actually both men and women's college soccer. So I've gone there. A lot of the times it's the college websites, just going and looking at, you know, what information they can provide. And also, especially in the last couple of years, there's been a proliferation of like college, like specific to a certain college blog, say on like SB Nation, where they cover every single, you know, sports team that school has. And they will, you know, say, you know, here's what they'll have recaps of games and some insight that you won't find through a sports information director. So it's kind of interesting. And then I also have to say, and I have something I've mentioned a couple times, Erica Walsh, the head coach of Penn State, was saying during one of the press conferences during the College Cup, just how much more women's soccer is being televised and it's available for you to watch, which is really good for them, obviously scouting, but it's also good for us because the more that's out there, the more information is going to be on these broadcasts. And I think this, the more it's on TV or the more it's available to on like watch ESPN, the more I think things will be written about it. So,
And it gets put up on YouTube. I mean, I was happy to find that, hey, the SAC final from 2013 was up. The ACC final from 2014 was up. You can rewatch the whole thing. It's in entirety, much like NWSL being on YouTube. It's so great that it's something you can go back and watch. And a lot of these colleges are putting up channels because, you know, being on TV is one thing, but the stuff on TV, once it's up, you normally can't see it again, you know. So I love that. I'm happier in some cases with a web stream because you end up having more access to it. My big frustration is as the proliferation of feeds has happened at the top end, as you get to the Final Four, it's only on ESPNU. and they geo-block it so you can't watch it on ESPN3, and I don't have a way to get ESPNU, and I'm like, you're killing me. I've gotten to watch all of it except, you know, so it's you know, then you go find a sports bar that has ESPNU, but it's like, why are you hiding this? Because I so clearly remember the first time I watched the College Cup, and of course it was 1999 because you had that big surge in paying attention, and of course Lori Fair from the 99 team, she actually retained her college eligibility. Could you imagine this in 2015? She forwent all the financial bonuses of winning the World Cup so that she could play her final season at North Carolina. Yeah. And so they played it out in San Jose, and I think they got like 20,000, you know, at the final. And it was so exciting. And it was on ESPN too, you know, but you can see how much ESPN has grown, that now they've got bigger things on ESPN2. So now it's on ESPNU. And I'm okay with the U if they would put it on ESPN3. But anyway, that's my rant. I've brought that up before. But I do totally agree with your point that there's so much more of it that's accessible to anyone, whether it's radio, a web stream, Pac-12 network, Big Ten network, something like that. It's great. And so more people do end up paying attention. And I think as we saw with the College Cup final, well, the whole Final Four this year, you know, being in North Carolina and Duke making it was so great to see the Duke fans' support of that, you know, that as long as there's some kind of local connection, you've got this huge, huge group that's coming out. And that's so great to see, because with a neutral site set in advance, you're not always going to have a team from the area make it. But that really took those games to a new level.
It was really amazing. And I think that them obviously making it to the final was obviously huge for turnout. But because I was there a couple of years ago when it was Florida was playing UCLA, or Florida State was playing UCLA in the final, and the turnout was not good, but the weather was awful as well. So
right.
I think that's a great venue for the College Cup. It's men and women's. It's a really great stadium, and they usually can coincide it with a women's, I know, like a girls tournament. So that mm-hmm. helps with turnout as well. I, you know, really did enjoy being able to be there. And I'm kind of hoping that they can grow upon, you know, obviously the World Cup last year is going to impact, I think, the college game as well, as far as the coverage and the interest and things like that. If it can keep up, that'll be great for that game as well. And I think just in general with sports, just in general, more things are available online, whether or not it's soccer or softball. It's just a ton more things are available, and I think that's great for women's sports, especially on the whole, since it's not on TV nearly enough.
Right, that like the whole landscape of broadcast is changing, that you don't necessarily have to be on TV because we're all changing our habits of how we, you know, digest that content, you know, mobile and on demand and all that stuff. But let's take a look at just an overview from your perspective of the 2015 NCAA Division I season. Of course, I'd love to be able to devote a lot of time to Division II and Division III and NAIA and junior college, but we'll focus on the colleges that are feeding players into the NWSL. So, you know, what are some of the highlights of the 2015 season for you?
I think for me, I was really blown away by this year's freshman class and how talented they really are. You saw some of that in the College Cup. Megan Connolly from Florida State, who's actually an Irish international, which is amazing. Then also for Duke, Taylor Rapisioki and Kayla McCoy. They were two leading scorers for Duke. And especially, you can just tell that there's a lot more room for growth, but just that they're able to be at this level and be impacting the game as much as they are. It's really promising, I think, for the future, you know, for not only those programs, but, and even though Tennessee didn't have a great year, Katie Cousins, who was the number one recruit in last year's class, or I guess the 2015 class. It was really fun just watching her on the ball for Tennessee, even though she's like 5 foot maybe, but just the way she can control the ball and distribute it was really amazing to watch that. So I think that was one of the main takeaways for me. And then I think also, and I talked about this a little bit in the article I wrote, well, good bit on the article I wrote for The Equalizer, was international players. They've been a part of the game for quite some time, but I think we're seeing them impact it at another level, you know, whether or not you're talking about, you know, obviously Raquel Rodriguez, who, you know, just won the Herman Trophy for the best player, you know, in the country. You know, obviously Florida State has an influx of internationals, Rachel Daly in Georgia, Carney Perry for St. John's, just taking that program to another level. It was just like everywhere you looked, there were internationals, you know, making an impact, you know, in their for their schools and for their conferences. And I think it's just, I think it's also going to help on a global level too, if you have the players continuing to play and getting an education. And you can, we can debate whether or not you, how good the college system is for developing players, but I think it's positive to see players continue playing, even if it's in college, past, you know, the high school level. So it's, I think those were the two big things that I really noticed from this year.
And that's a really good point, because I had the privilege of calling the Sun Belt Women's Conference final. And, you know, that was the first time I called a game where, you know, up until 3 days before the game, I didn't really know the teams at all. So I had to, you know, do a lot of studying and talk to those coaches. And the South Alabama program, and they won the final and actually won their first game in the NCAA tournament before, of course, falling to Florida State. But they have an interesting mix of English internationals and mostly Alabama players. And the coach is English. And he was so open and sharing and such a great talker about all of his players. He wasn't, you know, trying to hide any strategy or anything. But he talked about what he was trying to do was bring, you know, the best of the European style that we always talk about, technical and possession based and stuff like that. And then, you know, the fierce athleticism of the Americans and bring them together. He didn't want either style to win out. He wanted them, you know, to blend. And the way he worked with these players, the way he talked about these players, I was so impressed. Like the semifinal, they went to PKs and they actually went through 12 rounds of PKs. He let the players choose the order. This is how much he trusts them. He's like, I want them to yell at me when I'm wrong. I want them to be creative. I want them to think on the spot. I was like, oh my God. Like, and what he's done with this program in just 3 years, like I'm thinking in a couple of years, we're going to be seeing a player out of South Alabama in the NWSL. But yeah, I really noticed a lot more internationals where I would say, you know, just 5-10 years ago, any internationals in NCAA were generally Canadians, which of course makes a lot of sense, or they were in NIAA or junior college, but they weren't necessarily, you know, in Division I. So it's a neat change, and I agree with you. It's like, regardless of how you feel at soccer as a way to develop a player, it's great for the sport as a whole that you have more people coming in at a different talent level and bringing some of these programs up. Because I think when we look at the draft and we look at who's stated that who's registered for the draft so far, there's a lot of people on there and it's just not a very deep draft.
It is not at all. It is. And I think in a lot of ways, of course, I think it's challenging, more challenging for everybody involved this way, but it'll be interesting to see if, you know, maybe some of the players from the smaller conferences you were just talking about, like South Alabama, maybe some players that normally wouldn't get a shot would get a shot. And maybe they can kind of show that players from smaller conferences can make it a bigger level.
Right.
We really haven't seen a lot of that. I think
no.
Jen Hoy coming out of the Ivy League, probably maybe the out of the draft system, that is.
Right.
Maybe the exception. So it'll be interesting to see how that plays out.
Because a lot of people, you know, go back to Christy Rampone as coming out of a small college, but that was not because she was drafted. That was for however Tony DiCicco identified her, you know, that wasn't through the draft. You know, that was pre-WSA. And I still think that there's an automatic bias, and understandably that, you know, you're watching highlights of this player who's kicking ass left and right in one of the, you know, weaker conferences, and they'll be like, yeah, they're doing great, but look at the opponent. And so it's so hard to judge. And I think there's so many of these players and so much soccer to watch that maybe the coaches don't have the opportunity to really figure out if they can, like, who's got the best mentality. Like, okay, maybe she's got the skills, but is she ready to take it to the next level?
I mean, it's extremely hard to figure that out based on tape. And unless you have time to talk to the players and talk to the coaches, I've had several conversations with Mark Parsons, now the head coach of the Thorns, about mentality and how he thinks that that is basically the difference between a high level player and the player that can really make it at the pro level.
Right.
You know, being a good high level player and being a pro level is, he thinks a lot of that comes down to mentality. And that's something that can be very hard to judge from a tape. Like, you can kind of see if they're, you know, not afraid to take players on, and they're sort of their decision making. But It's very difficult. But there are definitely some smaller conferences that I think have a history of a very proud history in women's soccer that I think eventually there are going to be programs that do provide a player or two that does see time, you know, as a rostered player. I think that's eventually going to happen. That's just, you know, the mathematical side of it. It's just bound to happen.
Right. And with Orlando in the league now, so, you know, you've got 40 spots in this draft up from 36. And, you know, a lot of the team rosters, when you look at who they've already signed, there's not a lot of space on these rosters, really, apart from Houston. But, you know, like you said, maybe there's an opportunity down the line where maybe someone, you know, gets drafted in that fourth round and ends up making a mark. I think that's going to be really interesting to see how those lower rounds fall.
It's going to be very, very interesting. The draft itself is very heavy at center back, but then right. It's pretty light everywhere else. I mean, sitting down trying to think of, you know, just highlight five defenders, I'm like, well, I've got a list of seven or eight I'd really like to talk about, and trying to narrow it down because I don't want to be writing like all day. Where everywhere else, I'm kind of like, okay, this is a great player, but, you know, she's an international. I'm not sure how that is going to work out. There's also some players that have had injury concerns, and so that's definitely interesting how that's going to play out.
Right.
It's a mess. It's just a mess. Honestly, I think this is the hardest draft I've ever seen going in. At least, you know, we're only in year four, but I think 2013 was kind of a wash because just that was pretty much held in secret, so I don't think that many people were paying. It wasn't really a secret, but it wasn't a big deal made out about it, and there wasn't a lot of media there.
And it was it was a mix of college and just unassigned players. Like that first one was a very different ball of wax.
And so since then, I think the last two, I think you could had a bit more understanding of how it was going to play out.
Right.
But this year, especially, I think the talent level is lower. Even I think 2014 was a great draft. Last year was okay, but this year is even worse than last year, I think. So I think that, and then the coaching carousel. We don't even know two head coaches who they're going to be right now.
Yeah.
So that's interesting. And then all these international players, but we have more international spots than we've ever had. So I think that could potentially help.
And we still don't have the Canada allocation. So my big question is, you know, Janine Becky, well, it's like, well, if she becomes an allocated player, does she still go through the draft or not? Now Morgan Bryan and Crystal Dunn, they were the number one pick, so I think it was kind of already decided, but Janine's not necessarily the number one, so I don't, big question mark there.
She went through the draft system, so I think that might lean towards her going that way as well. But Becky is actually a dual citizen, so
right,
she's not going to take up an international spot. I've seen some confusion on that. I was like, yeah, I know she plays for Canada, but she's actually U.S. citizen. So,
well, even even as long as she's allocated, she doesn't take an international spot.
Yeah, that's true. Anyway. That's true.
But it's the kind of thing we don't have. Do we have absolute confirmation that she's allocated? And then if she is, well, does she go through the draft? Yeah, you know, like it's going to be interesting. And it was nice to get clarification too that, you know, that you can draft as many internationals as you want. It's just by the time you do your final roster, you have to, you know, be down to whatever your limit is, depending on, you know, what you
how many trades.
But yeah, there's so many variables. You know, I use this phrase a lot to describe the league. It's very much the Wild West where, you know, you can't go, well, this is going to happen. It's just like, well, let's just see. We don't know. And as you mentioned, you know, two teams not having a head coach, and of course that being Sky Blue and still the Flash, right? Still Western
yes.
Flash. You know, it's like, you can't even predict, like, well, this coach tends to do this. Like, no idea.
I think, too, this doesn't apply to teams where the coach is, in fact, the GM as well, like Laura Harvey.
Right.
But we're not even really sure how much, say, the coach has as opposed to the GM.
Right.
So that's interesting because I'm pretty sure with, say, Boston, I'm pretty sure it was not Tom Durkin last year. It was like, let's just take the players that want to come to Boston or have some sort of connection to Boston. I don't think that would have been his draft strategy. That came from somewhere else.
Right.
You know what I mean? Like, I don't see why a coach would say that. So it's really not, I mean, it's really not clear where the delineation of responsibilities are. So,
yeah. And I'm sure club to club, it's different.
Yeah. It's different too.
Yeah.
So it's going to be an interesting draft. And then you have a lot of teams that have a lot of holes, and then you have teams that are fairly well set, like a Seattle. So it'll be interesting to see need versus best available and who goes with what.
And I'm sure there's been a flurry of phone calls and emails over the last week in terms of trading away picks or trying to get more picks and, you know, just.
I mean, honestly, I was looking at the draft order today, and FC Kansas City, they have a pick at 8 and they have a pick at 18. But just based on the number of holes that they have and based on some of the holes that they have, that there aren't a lot of players that can really fill, if they're planning on filling these players with draft players, they may be a team that's looking to move up. It's not like other drafts where I think more teams would be willing to move up because there was talent there, but right.
I would almost see people maybe wanting to move down and getting more picks for a very high pick. So you could be like, well, at least I can pull in more people, get dibs on more people and see what happens.
See, next year's draft should be a lot better. So there may be teams that are willing to trade draft picks in this draft for even, say, a second round in this draft for a third round next year. Yeah. I don't know. So that's something that it seems like with the NWSL is very known for like these last minute deals and these last minute trades that seem to blow everything up. And it kind of gets blown up anyway, where some other leagues, you know, if you have a hole, you pretty much have to either trade or you go through the draft, where I think in the NWSL, you can also go get a player from overseas. You don't really have that option in, say, the NFL. Like that's not an option. That's a very interesting notion because we don't really know with some of these teams that have international spots left. You know, are they planning on using them? And B, if they are they not going to use them on draft players? And that can cut two ways because I know a lot of people, you want players to take up your international spots that you know you're going to get a player that can contribute to your team. But we've seen a lot of players come over in the last couple of years from overseas. And they don't do well because they're not acclimated to the culture, where these players that have been playing here for 4 years, yeah, they're still going to have to make that jump to the next level, but they understand American culture. Yeah, they might need to know a new city, but you know they understand the food, you know, dress, a lot of them.
And they've already seen the athleticism that kind of takes precedence over skill.
Skill, yes. So I think that could actually help. I think last year you saw probably more busts than ever. So I think teams may be willing to take a shot on some of these internationals in the draft.
And then I also wonder, you know, since we won't have the final qualifiers for the Olympics until February and March, you know, we won't know until early March if Australia is going, you know, we won't know till late February, you know, if it's USA and Canada or if it's someone else. So, you know, maybe it is a good thing to load up on the internationals of many different flavors and then just, you know, don't sign the ones who are going to the Olympics. I'm sure it's not that easy, but, you know, that there's so many more variables with the Olympics as opposed to this time last year. We already knew exactly who was going to the World Cup, so you could plan around that. And, of course, this year, you know, what little we've heard so far about the schedule is saying that they're not going to play during the Olympics, which of course is a much shorter tournament than the Women's World Cup. We don't know how long the players will be gone leading up to the Olympics, but you clearly won't have the same stretch of games without your major stars. So there's not necessarily the opportunity for amateurs to maybe play their way into a contract, whether it's NWSL or somewhere else, where we had that very clear period last spring, early summer with NWSL where, okay, here's the little second chunk of the season when the stars are gone, you know? So I'm sure that factors into a lot of roster decisions.
It's funny though, but you still gotta, especially, you know, with the US allocations and I think with the Canadian allocations, because you understand that more than likely those are the two teams going from CONCACAF.
Right.
You have to have cover though, too, for those players because there are going to be times that they're not there.
Right.
So it'll be interesting to see how that plays out. and obviously, for the first time in a while, we have two teams, I think, that really need goalkeepers, and whether or not they go through the draft or not, and how that all plays out. I'm going on the assumption that there is, you know, the additional goalkeeper that's being allocated sometime this week.
You're right.
So it's interesting because right now it looks like there's more than two teams that need goalkeepers, but it's interesting because you just don't know how that plays into it. You can look at history and kind of look at where they've taken goalkeepers because there isn't so much of a run on them.
Right.
But it's just, there's so many factors. I think that in any sport, drafts are kind of a crapshoot to kind of sort of forecast how it's going to all play out. But this year, it seems like it's very, probably more volatile than any other year that we've seen.
Yeah. Well, last topic for you, you know, who are your top five, and not who do you think is going to go top five, because I know it's going to be so hard to call. But you know, if you were a club and you got to pick the first five players, who would you pick? Free for all.
Yeah. I think you've heard a lot about Emily Sonnet, and
right.
Obviously, and I would definitely say she's a top five pick. She's just so calm on the ball. She's been the leader of the UVA defense for the last 2 years. She was the only returning starter fall of 2014. So she's so calm on the ball. She, you know, sees the game very well. I understand exactly why, you know, she's in the conversation for the number one pick and presumably is a number one pick.
Mm-hmm.
It's funny because I think we could see a situation, and I know you said not in the order that I think we'll be taking the draft, but if you had asked me in April who I thought was the number one pick, I probably would have said there's a very strong argument for Sonnet's teammate, Mackenzie Doniak. She's clearly the most developed forward in this draft. She had two seasons where she scored 20 goals, and that's playing in the ACC, and some of the toughest games in the country are played there. She makes everyone around her better, and I think the last April, Virginia played Washington in a preseason match, and she didn't score the goal, but she made the Spirit defense, obviously this preseason, she didn't have everybody yet, she made them look silly quite a number of times, and it was just clear that this is a player that's going to have an impact on the next level. She's deceptively fast, because you didn't think she's, you know, 5'8", deceptively fast. You didn't think she'll be as fast as she is, but she's a great overall, all-around forward, and I think she's definitely up there. Raquel Rodriguez, who we've, you know, already mentioned.
Right.
Clearly the best midfielder in this draft, and is not even close. Last year, she was a little bit more offensive-minded, won the College Boot Award. This year, she had a little bit different role, and, you know, sitting back a little bit further, which she accepted, and she played very well. She's great on, you know, offensively and defensively. She's creative. Just a good old, like, hey, did you keep saying the world all around? But I think she could play a couple different types of midfielder. So I could definitely say assuming she wants to play in NWSL. Yes, she's declared, but that doesn't mean she won't end up playing elsewhere. So I think that's obviously a huge issue because she's got the talent to play in another league too.
Yeah.
Yeah. Carrie Recaro obviously is up there. I think she's, you know, played on two U20 World Cup teams, you know, team captain in the last one. She's a versatile player, especially when Randy Waldron was the head coach at Notre Dame. She kind of got thrown around wherever he needed. I remember specifically a game, Notre Dame versus Virginia a couple of years ago. She literally played on every line during that game. Only in college soccer do you see that. But I think when you see a player that has the ability to do that, you definitely see a player that has the ability to make it to that next level.
Right.
She's really good at breaking stuff up before it happens, which is the kind of thing that people don't tend to notice, but she's very good at that. So I definitely think she should be a top four pick, top three maybe even. And then I think the fifth spot is where it gets a little bit interesting. Katie Bowen from UNC. She's a New Zealand international. Her dad is English, though, so that makes me wonder. I know you keep saying, like, if I could pick anybody.
Right.
She can play anywhere in the midfield or anywhere on the back line and plays very well there. And I think that, you know, at the next level, obviously, I think most of the time coaches do want to have you pick one position and stay there. But I think having a player that you can kind of mold into one position is something that a lot of coaches, I think, would be interested in. And I feel like I do need to mention Janine Becky, even though I'm not really sure is she going to be allocated or not, because right. I feel to be honest, I had no idea how many goals she had scored at Texas Tech until I really looked at it. And I was just blown away. I mean, 57 goals, a ton, especially when you consider, I know at times, you know, she's out with, you know, U20 World Cup and stuff like right. that with Canada. That's, you know, a ton. I think I knew she was a good, but I hadn't really actually sat down and looked at the numbers. For me, I think the thing that sealed it for me was in the Big 12 semifinal this year, she had to beat the best player in the country, period, and Kadisha Buchanan to score the goal that sent them to the final, and they ended up winning the Big 12 title. She did that, and she had to beat her compatriot on the Canadian national team to score it. But it was just interesting to see her do that, because I mean, Buchanan was right there with her, but she, you know, was able to do that. And I think Buchanan obviously is going to be playing professionally, and she's going to be one of the best center backs in the world. I don't think anybody really questions that now. So to be able to score on her in a game, and West Virginia doesn't give up goals. So for me, that was really, I think, one of the things that was like, yeah, she's going to be there. It's just a matter of whether or not she gets allocated. So if she gets allocated, some team is getting a really good player, and it'll be exciting to see, you know, whether or not she makes it, I guess, if Canada makes it to the Olympics, yeah. If she's on the team or not. But I still think she's a tremendous player, and I think it's going to be interesting to watch her. I know you said five and I said six. I apologize.
That's okay. I really think she is one of the key pieces that has helped Tech take it to the next level. You know, they had a really great run in the tournament last year, not quite as deep this year, you know, and being coached by Tom Stone, who had three seasons in the WSA, the only coach whose team made the playoffs all three seasons. You know, I wonder if there's, you know, a little bit of coaching advantage there that maybe he can help mold a player who's going to take it to the next level, having seen that level. But
I mean, Hinkle obviously went to Texas Tech as well. And it's funny because they're both from Colorado Springs. So that's an interesting connection. It'd be interesting to see if she doesn't get allocated, if she ends up in Western New York, or I don't think she'd fall that far, but it's just interesting how interconnected soccer in general is sometimes.
Yeah, very interconnected. Well, Jennifer, thank you so much for all your thoughts today, and I'm sure I'll be seeing you later this week in Baltimore at the draft, and it's going to be fun.
Yeah, thanks so much for having me.
All right, time to wrap it up with the back four. Announcing the first ever Keeper Notes WOSOCO. And you're wondering, what the hell is a WOSOCO? I'm talking Women's Soccer Conference, WOSOCO. This one-day event will be held Saturday, February 20th in Houston, Texas. And that is the day between the CONCACAF Olympic qualifying semifinals and final in Houston. Hal Kaiser and I will each lead one session, and there will also be a Q&A with special NWSL guests in attendance. For more information, check out keepernotes.com and just click on WOSOCO on the main tab. And of course, feel free to email me with any questions at keeper@keepernotes.com. And speaking of CONCACAF Olympic qualifying, individual tickets are now on sale for all matches in both Frisco and Houston. Frisco will host the Group A games featuring USA, Mexico, Costa Rica, and Puerto Rico, while Houston will have the Group B games with Canada, Guatemala, Guyana, and Trinidad and Tobago. Plus, Houston will also host the semifinals and final. Bayou City Republic, the Dash supporters group, has arranged a special hotel rate for all fans traveling to Houston for the weekend of the semifinal and final, and is working with Keeper Notes as well as American Outlaws to organize other fan events for those coming to the Bayou City. I will keep adding information to the WOSOCO page, and you can also check out Bayou City Republic on Facebook as well. You can reach out to me at Keeper Notes, to Hal at Hal_Kaiser, or to Bayou City Republic on Twitter with any questions if you've never been to Houston and wondering what you want to do. So we already chatted about the FIFA winner, so I want to make sure to give a shout-out to Raquel Rodriguez of Penn State, winner of the 2015 Mac Herman Trophy for Best Women's College Soccer Player. She was awarded the trophy last Friday in a special ceremony in St. Louis, along with Jordan Morris from Stanford, who won the men's award. Rodriguez is the first Penn State player to win since Christy Welsh in 2001, and she scored the game-winning goal versus Duke in the NCAA final last month. She is very likely a top three pick in Friday's NWSL draft. And speaking of the draft, one more time, it's this Friday, starting at 10 a.m. Eastern. So that means 9 a.m. Central, 8 a.m. Mountain, 7 a.m. for the West Coast. Yes, there will be online coverage, really. Just keep an eye on NWSL Twitter. All right, I want to thank everybody for listening. As always, you can subscribe via iTunes. You can find us on TuneIn, Stitcher, Podomatic. You can also go to howlermagazine.com, click on podcasts. Want to give a big shout out to Howler Magazine. It's been a year since they've started supporting the Mix Zone, and it's been great. And of course, you can support the Mix Zone by telling other people about this podcast. So please spread the word. And thanks, as always, to PK Ray for making this podcast possible.